It occupies a big chunk of the Deadwood book. Buy the Deadwood book on Amazon.com. Click on the link to comedicmovie.club.
We're not recording anymore. I've never started recording anymore.
Do you say that like when you're in conversation with people?
No, I don't.
The following is a Mediocre Movie Club production.
Welcome back to the Mediocre Movie Club podcast, Deadwood Edition, in which we go through a series rewind of one of the greatest TV shows ever made. I'm Deacon of the Third Baptist Church of Monrovia, John Kissel, and with me tonight to discuss these three episodes is Little Boy Fucking Lost, Shane Settner.
Yo!
And the lethally fucking middled Brian Hartman.
That's me.
Shane and I are Deadwood repeat viewers, therefore enjoying high levels of popularity with our fellow white people, while Brian is our Deadwood rookie. But better late than fucking never.
Hold on. I always have to comment
please,
after this.
Yeah, go ahead.
Does this mean I'm here with non-white people here in Central Illinois?
It's just me and Shane think about it more.
I think you've got that switch.
Wondering what's our status with our fellow white people. I know I'm always wondering that.
Yeah.
In this episode, we're going to do something a little different. Not that different. We're just doing more. We're just packing more into this episode. So it's not like the biggest strike of genius we've ever had before. But these three episodes and the next three episodes and the final two episodes of Deadwood just work very well together. So we're going to eschew just talking about two episodes at a time. We're going to talk about three episodes in this episode of the Mediocre Movie Club podcast. We're doing the fifth and sixth and seventh episodes of the third season, which are entitled Two-Headed Beast, A Rich Find, and Unauthorized Cinnamon. These three episodes are all about instigation. The camp is just poking the George Hurst bear. And the big way they do that, just to jump straight into the synopsis, is that Bullock arrests Hurst after he has the third Cornish organizer killed and planted in the middle of the thoroughfare for all to see. In response to this arrest, we have another meeting. The peaches are cracked open and brought out, and they decide what to do about this and Hearst's inevitable retaliation. And their decision is to go the nonviolent route. They're going to publish a letter in the Deadwood Pioneer, just humanizing the victim. I forgot how much I loved the seventh episode in which this meeting occurs. I found myself just on the couch in a puddle of tears, listening to Merrick read the letter about Pasco the Cornishman and how he was not just an obstacle or an impediment for Hurst, but he was a human being with a life and a family, and Hurst had him murdered for wanting more for himself and his family and his fellow workers.
Do they show the Cornishman? Is that in seven or is that I thought it was
it's
early.
Five. Yeah. In five.
So so there's a long time. Yeah. It was very confusing. Well, that you went from five to seven.
Well, these three episodes take place over 2 days. The second two take place. The six takes place in the afternoon and seven takes place in the evening. And then.
Oh, that's fine. I was just making sure I'm not crazy.
Not a lot of time is going by. They find him dead with the knife sticking out and shot to look like a flag. Like the camera is behind the Cornishman's body, looking upwards, and the knife just looks like a flagpole or the like. And then in six, they discuss possible retaliation, and then in seven, they resolve to do what they do.
Gotcha. I didn't think it was filmed to look like a flag. I think it was filmed to get American Blazonov's reaction while continuing to show the body.
Sure, but then there's like the shot of Bullock standing over the body later after they get him. That's what I'm specifically referring to. Here nor there. But like the first Cornishman killed, they tried to pawn it off as a bar fight. Plausible deniability there. The second one, they frame it to look like an accident. And then by the third time, they're just dragging a body out into the street with a knife in his chest. Like Hearst workers are dragging him out, not the miners, people that are his hitmen. So it's past the point of giving a shit anymore. He's the last one, and they don't have to dress it up anymore. So Hurst is stepping his game up, and the town is deciding through Bullock, which pretty much everyone agrees, including Bullock himself, in what is not a great idea, to like drag Hurst to jail by the ear. And by the end of the seventh episode, they are awaiting his response. I feel like this is unique in all of television, where your response to the big bad could be something like this and have it be so obviously the right thing to do. As Langrish says, to proclaim a law beyond law to a man without law is noble and good.
Right. It seems like it's something that would actually, it seems like something that would actually happen in real life where they don't rush to judgment.
Yes. Yeah. Humanizing the victim. It's not just about what the bad guy is doing. It's about who the bad guy did it to. And it's a stroke of tender, empathetic genius on the show's part, in a show that's not often tender. And, well, it's always empathetic, but it's certainly not as heartfelt as it is in some of those moments in Unauthorized Cinnamon.
I guess that leads me to that. I take this as less as poking the bear. This is kind of like responding, like, because poke the bear, it feels like you're going out of the way just to poke at a sleeping bear.
Mm-hmm.
This one, the bear is looming over you and is threatening the entire time, and it's a response to that threat and to strike first. Some people do that, some people wait. So I guess fight or flight, right? And then there are some people who have clarity in those situations. That would be Al in this one and getting pissed off at everyone for fucking up his plans. But then they finally sit down with Al and say, okay, we're going to do this right. We're going to respond correctly to this bear that's sitting in our living room.
Yeah.
Let's feed it honey. Bears like honey.
We're going to poison it with human misery, but yes, honey. And what makes the letter and the reading of it more poignant is that the show in the meeting itself and in the early episode with Charlie in his discussion with Bullock and Starr about potentially bushwhacking Hurst and his operation, they give you an alternative. And I think like that would have been an incredible ending too. Like a big conflagration between the forces of Deadwood and the forces of Hurst, just running into each other, Braveheart style. That would have been all right, but it just wouldn't have worked for the show. That period of time is over.
Well, hold on. Deadwood. You have now told me what the ending is not. This is still not out of the realm of possibility in my mind.
It's not. No, it's not. It. But they've decided that that's not what they're going to do. Hurst can do whatever the fuck he wants to do. I don't think I spoiled it at all.
All
right. The town fathers are resolved in the printing of this letter. Hurst will do what he's going to do. If this stage is instigation, then, I mean, what comes after instigation? Retaliation is going to be the next three episodes. Or escalation, something like that. I don't know. I came up with a better word for it downstairs while I was getting ready. But yeah, there are distinct phases to the final swing of the series. And it just breaks down really nicely that the printing of a letter, just a letter to a family that, and the letter not mentioning Hurst, it's just very fitting that there's no amount of force that they can marshal to take Hurst down, but they can appeal past him. They can get it in history and in the record that he trampled over people, and that, you know, that's worth something. Before Hurst is arrested, Hurst is drunk because he's sad, and he's sad because Captain Turner has been killed in the fifth episode. Hurst instigates a fight between Dan and Captain Turner to the object of scaring the rest of the camp. Captain Turner takes down this big lumbering enforcer for the camp chief, and that's going to scare everybody, but it goes the other way. I hate to just use superlative after superlative and talking about like the plot development and Unauthorized Cinnamon, but In Two-Headed Beast, episode 5, I would challenge anyone to come up with like a greater display of violence in TV history.
I've been trying to think of comparable fights all day. That, I mean, it didn't just show, it wasn't just a tense, good fight. I mean, it was just absolutely brutal and shows you fights are fucking hard.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just like punch and pop back up, and it's just nuts.
And it's established that like Captain Turner has been in these fights before. If he's a pro street fighter, this is as graceful as it's going to get. Like, they're not miking the punches extra. It's not making that whatever sound that like Indiana Jones makes when he punches somebody. It's just like a wet thud whenever they punch.
I thought the fight scene was, you know, comparable to what we've seen in quality movies and TV. Not that I have a memory to know off the top of my head exactly which one. I thought the buildup was really, really good. Dan oiling himself up.
Mm-hmm.
And Captain Turner doing trunk twisters.
Mm-hmm. old-timey exercise. Like, his next step was going to get in one of those like band machines that vibrates you really fast.
Right. We do something similar to what he was doing in cross country as part of our warm up. Is that twisting? Is that
stuff?
Yeah, some of those are really good for your hips. Actually,
he knows what he's doing, Captain Turner.
I mean, yeah. Do you also like have a wry smile when you realize the other person doesn't want any weaponry in your cross country meets?
Yes. Wow. There's
so many. Yeah, it's packed with little touches. I mean, the big touch of the stagecoach running across as like a starter pistol for them to charge at each other.
That's great.
And then, yeah, Dan discarding his knife. And Ed, like we remarked when we were watching it, like Captain Turner's little smile, like, you know what you're doing too, buddy. It's the mutual respect that comes in again after the fight when Dan is so broken up about it. And Al has a lot of sympathy for him too, because just that whole thing is so, so ugly. And to be a part of it,
like,
how could you? Yeah.
Did you have an emotional response to this fight?
Brian?
Me?
Yes.
A little bit. I was more like happy with how they let up. Like, I was super nervous for, I felt like we were going to lose a main character, and I was going to be heartbroken over it.
Yes.
And they set it up in the previous episode. We didn't mention it in the last podcast because I didn't want to tip anything to you, but after Dan is once again sulking about Al not choosing him for a task, Al goes and talks with him, and they talk about all of their previous encounters and how much shit they've been through. If Dan had died in that fight and you watch the series over again, like that's a scene that tips you to, okay, Dan and Al have had their last words. And I mean, the fight itself, like it's pure luck and happenstance that it goes the way it does. Like, as far as emotional reactions go, I have a clear memory of watching this episode in the fall of 2006, when I was supposed to be going to my Colonial America class at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Instead, this seems like it would suffice for
replacing
that class.
Definitely. And Dr. Gann at the University of Evansville probably would have gone for that if I could have sold it to him in talking about like the formation of civilization that Deadwood is all about.
What if you're pulling a guy's eye out on the moon?
What does it sound like?
It would just float up, you know? It wouldn't go down like right on Earth, you know?
I had started this episode knowing that I was going to have to like stop it if I was going to make class. But then once it became clear that the fight was going to happen, I resolved to not go to class. And I just sat there wrapped in my chair as the fight is happening and then just sprang up like I was shot out of an airbag a la the Neighbors movie and cheered and yelled. When the eye comes out, I was just on the, as cliche as it is to say it, I was on the absolute edge of my seat. Like, this isn't my favorite scene in Deadwood, I guess, just because that bar is so high, but it's the most emotionally attached I had ever felt to a television show up to that moment. And maybe still, like, I only jumped out of my chair 2 more times since then.
What are the other two?
Like, they were both Game of Thrones related.
Ah.
But
what Game of Thrones related?
When Rob throws Jamie down in the first season after capturing him, that just completely surprised me. And like the tone of it was going like the Starks are clearly going to lose. They're so vastly outnumbered and things are going badly. It was before I knew it was going to happen to Ned too. And then at the Red Wedding, when Rob's wife gets stabbed in the stomach, just because it's so brutal and sudden. And
yeah, that I don't think I'll be ever able to forget that episode.
I haven't watched it again. That's actually when I quit rewatching the series over again, is I got to like right before that episode and then called it. But here nor there.
Yeah, it's actually, it's funny you say, like, the only, because I watched a lot of this in bed the first time I watched it on my phone or an iPad, and I remember not being able to react to it because Blair's sleeping. And I was just there like, holy shit. And then the only other time I remember something like that was The Red Wedding. Yeah. Reading The Red Wedding, actually.
Yeah.
I think I texted you immediately.
That ruined my day at work. I shouldn't, potential employers, don't let that statement impact my prospects for a job. It was totally made in jest.
So if you're working,
I certainly wasn't reading fantasy tomes when I should have been working. That never happened. Anything else to say on like the fight itself? It's very gladiatorial. It's just, it's trading in human flesh. Just that quality of it, like these two great men sending their vassals out to fight each other to the death. And it's so ugly. As great as the result is, Al did send out someone who looks to him as a father to die. 50-50 shot, probably less than that. But that's just, that's the level that Hurst has brought the camp to. That's where he wants it, because he knows that he's unbeatable if that's the level of play. And that's a great kickoff to like the next part of the season. Let's bring it down perhaps with a couple of drops of laudanum as we talk about Alma and the dissolution of her marriage to Whitney Conway Ellsworth. This is my scene of the week, where she gets high and propositions Ellsworth and then notices and it goes from there. But Brian, you have a note about the Leon side of Alma's plot, where he is supplying her. Cy gets wind of that and then devises a way to have Alma killed and her claim put into contest. I mean, Leon and Khan both, like Khan, again, with the Bella Union flunkies, Khan's off in a spasm of sex interests. And Leon becomes integral to the plot in these few episodes. And he doesn't react well.
He's a pretty awful person.
Yeah, he's a dirtbag.
His scene, like, he's a dirtbag, but like his scene being high in the street talking to his reflection in the mud puddle.
Yeah.
That's easily his best scene. Where he's like waffling on what to do, and he's like, finally, he's starting to get it here for just a minute, even though he's high as a kite.
Yeah, he incorporates like stage direction into his soliloquy, where he's like tightroping around the edge of the puddle.
Yeah, I think he's a great character. He's just so self-loathing, different than the way that Steve is.
Oh, we'll talk about Steve.
Yeah, it's just. It's almost like an addict was writing this whole thing.
Yeah, this Leon's a guy that Milt has shot up with.
Yes, and I mean, and that's why Alma. I mean, her reactions to the whole thing.
Yeah,
is so well acted. Just the subtleties of all of it. Milt obviously has his hands all over it, and it's just so well done.
Even something that's potentially corny is like Alma walking down the stairs and whispering to herself, I want to be good, I want to be good. That's something that children say to each other, but it's so beyond a heroin addict's capabilities. Like they have to go to an impulse so primal and childish and elemental to try and get to normal behavior.
How do we know that Leon isn't Milch writing himself into these shows?
Milch writes the series. Other writers are credited, but he writes the series. I don't understand what the other writers are doing. I think they function as a sounding board. I'm not, like, there are the extras on the season 2 DVDs. Click on the link for Amazon at MediocreMovie.club and go to Amazon and buy the Deadwood DVDs. Anyways, one of the extras, it shows his writing process. And there's like a projection screen of just a Word document. And he has a bad back, so he lies on the floor in front of it. And there's.
Is he on his belly or is he on his back?
He's on his side. He's on his side.
Huh. He's used to play Civilization when I threw my back out. I moved my computer on the floor and I just laid on my belly and would play Civilization for hours.
Did it work?
Well, yeah, because when you throw out your back, you're supposed to lay on your belly.
You should write a book for people with back pain. partner with Firaxis, and
it already exists. It's called Treat Your Own Back. I was just it's a great book. You should get on Amazon and click on our link.
Well,
buy two things.
Buy Treat Your Own Back and the Dead, and lay on the ground and watch the Deadwood DVDs, which you also purchased through our link.
Yeah, and then when you have to go for bathroom breaks, maybe buy the Deadwood book, Tales of the Black Hills, and bring it to the bathroom with you, and you don't have to break the chain then.
I thought you were going to go with like adult diapers through our Amazon.
The best way to afford all this is for you to fall down at work. On my back, you call me. Call Benzene Law Group. We'll help you with your workers' compensation case. Got a back fusion possibility, man. That's probably $80,000 I got you. Right,
serious injury, long term, chronic.
Yeah, chronic.
But anyways, so there's the projection screen, and there's Milch on his side, and then there are like two rows of writers behind him with their laptops out, and Milch will dictate a line. And then he'll say, remove this word, add this word, remove this word, and just chew it over. And then on occasion, he'll ask the group for like input. How do we get this character due to this? What's the better line here? But he's the one dictating the script. So he writes everything. Everything in the show comes with Milch's. If it didn't come out of his head, it 100% had his approval.
And then he redoes all the script anyway.
Yes. Yeah,
it's like beforehand anyway.
Yeah. If you're Leon, you're reciting that soliloquy. Like maybe you rehearsed it the night before, and then you would show up on set the day of, and maybe it's completely rewritten. Maybe there's an extra page added to it. So this is why Deadwood was canceled more than anything, just because when that's your production, it's just going to take you a long time. I mean, obviously the result is on screen, but it's not economical. In any way.
Can't get back to Brian's point, is Leon Milch? probably, but he's also probably Alma at one point, too. These things just take you down and down and down. They drag you further and further down. And Alma is, she can't really be dragged down because she has all the money she needs. She has a good place in society. There's no one else other than a daughter can't control anything to really worry about except for Ellsworth. And you know that's when he dissolves their marriage.
Yeah.
When he notices it. And I think it's interesting because Ellsworth is such a good guy. He blames it on himself, and it has nothing, I mean, it's nothing to do with him.
Yeah, like Ellsworth could be anybody. He's a pretty good facsimile of a husband. Like he treats her okay. Like he did a little victim blaming in the previous episode, clouded by his anger for Hurst. So he's been a bit of a dick to her, certainly. He doesn't treat her as well as he possibly could, but as far as what she needed in that moment, he was that. And I mean, we like Ellsworth because he's like a salt of the earth guy who's brought himself up. Her who went down to nothing after his family died, presumably, and then came all the way back. And because he's got like the thesis statement of the show, but yeah, her problem.
What's his thesis statement?
I may have fucked my life up, flatter and hammer and shit, but I stand before you beholden to no human cocksucker.
Hmm.
It's just that the world, you can start the world over. You can burn the world down and you can start the world over. But yeah, I'll talk about more about Alma in the scenes of the week. Yeah, good stuff all around from Leon and Alma and Ellsworth. That Leon interjected in there. He's acting with different people, which is always fun to see. We mentioned Steve earlier. I mean, Milch has been Leon, Milch has been Alma. Milch has maybe been Steve once or twice in his life. Just very drunk and lashing out at everybody. Hopefully not in such a racist fashion, but here nor there. The business with delivery gets resolved, but he just cannot leave well enough alone. Remember when he jerked off on that horse? Steve just insists on getting that chalkboard back, and he will not treat Hostetler as someone who deserves the barest minimum shred of doubt. And out of pride, Hostetler kills himself, and then Steve.
That was super messed up. Like that was shocking.
Yeah, yeah.
I did not see that coming. Like, I actually had to rewind it to make sure he didn't get shot by somebody. So I wasn't sure what happened.
He's been threatening that as long back as like the previous season. After the horse got away, who knows? It's hard to suicide's just a hard thing to wrap a head around. And I mean, in that moment, it seems pretty impulsive.
Poor use of words in this case. Gissel.
What did I say? Or wipe your head around? I could have said wrap your head around, so it could have been worse. Steve spends the next two episodes trying to absolve himself, and he just can't help but feel bad anyways. And then at the end of episode 7, it's all civilization playing out in the livery. Two people that don't like each other and don't trust each other, and one of them goes to bed saying, "I promise not to murder you if you promise not to murder me." That was a good scene.
I really like that one.
Yeah, that's how then, and from that we now are able to podcast,
have air conditioning,
to podcast out into the ether for a handful of people that maybe give a shit what we have to say or don't.
Well, let's take a little break here and think, what would you snack on if you could snack on something right now?
I really love popcorn.
Yeah.
It's like my go-to snack now.
Kissel brought a popcorn maker down here.
A little crunchy for a podcast.
I've done it.
Maybe like Laffy Taffy.
I'm not going to eat during a podcast.
Of course, but that's the question.
The question is, what would you snack on if you could snack on something right now?
Like while we're podcasting?
Yeah,
I thought you meant assuming we're not podcasting.
I don't know. Everything you do, Deb. I think peaches actually would be a good choice. Canned peaches.
If you put motherfucking cinnamon on the motherfucking table.
It's insane.
Planted a pecan tree in my last house, and then I hired my neighbor to mow my lawn, and I was like, hey, don't mow where the pieces of wood are, because that's a tree and those are, you know, blackberry and raspberry bushes. Can you guess what he did?
Mowed down the pecan tree?
Followed your instructions to the letter.
All of it.
I guessed wrong.
Yeah. Hey, neighbor, do a good job cutting your tree down.
We also just brought a tree down in our yard. We had like a 30-foot pine tree that was dying.
Oh.
For our Atlanta listeners, I was just at the Pont City Farmer's Market. Pont City Market, Farmer's Market? I don't know. I can't remember.
Pont City Market.
Pont City Market, yeah. Farmer's Market.
Okay.
I considered buying peaches, but I instead bought garbage tomatoes from a garbage vendor.
Yeah.
Very disappointing.
I'll tell you what. Southern Indiana peaches and the peaches I'm growing are so much better than peaches in the South. Those peaches in the South aren't
very
good.
Would you perhaps put those peaches in a cobbler and serve them to your child as he's returning from Liberia?
Chelsea makes a mean peach pie. That's pretty close.
So Aunt Lou's son, Odell, arrives in camp.
I wasn't sure what parts of this we were recording for the podcast, so I was just friendly banter.
We'll hop back in there after a certain point.
This is all going in.
I've been editing like crazy. So
do not edit this. So no, it's all staying in.
Okay.
It all stays in.
So
above average fan Dave likes our tangents most, and he's probably 20% of the people who listen. I'm another 20%. John's
20%.
No.
Now we're at 80.
No.
So who
I'm
is
not
that
20%.
Person?
Riley's. Oh, no. Riley
sure
makes 80.
Have,
John doesn't
if
listen
If you
to
look
himself.
At our Weebly stats, we've been skyrocketing somehow. I don't know what that's about.
Really? Out of Deadwood stuff, too?
No.
It's
but just
all.
In general.
Oh,
in
that's
general.
Awesome.
Well, here's what happens.
So thanks,
is,
fans.
Yeah.
We very much appreciate your patronage.
Anytime we post a podcast, it automatically downloads to everyone who has subscribed.
That's great.
And those count as page views because their podcast app had to go out and grab the podcast.
We are churning out podcasts. Yeah. We're on a good, strong weekly.
Oh my gosh, we do have a ton.
I think it's great.
Of page views. This is insane.
Yeah, it's a lot. Anyways, all right. Who's also got a lot of page views is Odell. who brings pages of documents back with him from the Third Monrovia Church, or Third Baptist Church in Monrovia. There's a gold discovery there, and he, using Aunt Lou as the intermediary, is trying to get to Hearst to get him to invest in the gold mine, and Hearst is very skeptical, not just because of his racism and because... Odell's a little bit of a shady character in the first place, as much as we get to see of him. And Aunt Lou, of course, is also very concerned about her child because she knows what Hearst is capable of. These scenes, I think, function best as a window into Hearst's philosophy. I was thinking before the podcast about like Rick Santorum, who is like forever associated with the aftermath of anal sex, thanks to Dan Savage and Santorum being... you know, a strict definition of a word now. Maybe not the strict definition, but when you Google Santorum, you'll find out what I mean. But
who had that? I thought
with your kids around.
Yeah, maybe not on a work computer.
Was Colbert involved with that?
I think that was just Dan Savage.
I don't know who Dan Savage is.
He's a sex columnist, sex advice columnist. He's like Dear Abby, but about boners.
Are you sure that Colbert or Stewart weren't involved with that?
I don't think
one
so.
Or both.
I don't think so. But anyways, I'm sure Rick Santorum doesn't like to feel embarrassed.
One or both set mention on the show for sure. 100%.
Yeah, because it's funny. It's funny.
It is funny.
But I'm sure he doesn't like to feel that embarrassment. But he also feels very strongly about gays being evil or whatever he feels, and that's just the cross that he bears. And we see a mirror of that in Hearst. Like, he doesn't like being hated in these places, but he has such a grand picture of bringing gold into the economy and therefore eliminating color barriers that's his cross to bear is consolidation and macroeconomics. Little things like I'd like the children to continue to go to school in Deadwood. Who gives a shit when I'm talking about bringing gold as a way to bring black people into the world? And how sentimental he is about all this bullshit, too. Like, he makes himself cry in the middle of the thoroughfare. He's just so full of shit. But I have no doubt that there are many, many people that feel essentially the exact same way. Anything to add about Mount Lou and Odell?
I still don't know if Odell's telling the truth or not. Like, he showed up, I was like, oh, this is interesting. There's gold in Liberia. And then I was like, oh, he's totally making all this stuff up. And then by the end, I couldn't tell anymore, which is nice. I like not knowing.
I think based on these scenes, it would be reasonable to assume that it's maybe inflated.
I'm in camp, 75%. He's not telling the truth about what's going on. But there's still a smidgen of me that thinks he could.
Yeah. Like, if there isn't some gold there, like, what's his end game? Just like, Hearst Mann is going to go out there and find nothing. And then what's going
to
happen?
That's just a testament to the acting job of Cuba Gooding Jr. And who's also been, what is it, Snow Dogs.
Yes, and Boat Trip.
Boat Trip and Radio.
Ooh, Radio.
The
modern classic.
The inspiring story of a special person. Inspiring football players, I assume? I don't know.
It's something like that.
I didn't watch it.
I don't know. I think he's 40 or something in the movie. Odell, of course, played by Cuba Gooding Jr.'s brother, Omar.
Oh, this is Omar?
Yes.
I never knew this entire time. I thought that was
Cuba Gooding.
Now I don't know what part of Shane is telling the truth, and I'm just wrapped up in confusion.
I could have, like, I honestly
George Hurst in the scenario,
I thought that was Cuba Gooding the entire time.
Omar Gooding is best known for his part in Playmakers, the TV series about the NFL that the NFL on ESPN that the NFL shut down. That was pretty good, but he played a rookie running back on that.
God damn it.
Is this their concussion thing?
They look alike.
They shut down.
It
was part of it. Yeah.
I think it was. I think in the pilot, one of the main characters was a linebacker, paralyzed somebody on an opposing team.
Hmm. Football. All
right, I'm looking at Omar and Cuba Gooding, and it's so much alike.
All right,
it's insane.
Theater troupe.
I feel like Kissel now. I feel like a racist for thinking black people look alike.
Yeah. Anyways, the theater troupe. We resolved in the last episode to try and parse what was going on in the theater troupe. Who's related to who and what the relationships are. This week is pretty straightforward.
It's pretty stupid involving them. Like, I was kind of on board with them. Like, I was curious. And after these three episodes, I don't even care. And I just want them out of there.
Let me give you...
Look at that.
Yeah, they look a lot alike.
I don't want to talk about the theater people. Can we just keep moving on?
Exactly.
The most interesting thing happened was they got into Murphy's Rules of Order type business situation and form committees.
That is cinematic, I think, just because the band, it's like going quick and you got to get your words in quick. I enjoy those kind of scenes. I do like Chesterton, the dying old man, just because his back and forth with Langrish is pretty funny. If you didn't like this week with the theater people, prepare to be disappointed. I don't think it's ruining anything to say it doesn't get better. You might change your tune in episode 10, Brian, when they perform Les Miserables for the first time.
Oh yeah,
for the Camp of Deadwood. But that is a ways away, and it doesn't really work with four people. That's a big cast in that play.
Think they'll do like an early version of Hamilton? Because I've been listening to a lot of that.
No, I don't, because it's all black people in Hamilton, and that would not have flown in the 1870s.
Actually, blackface would have flown in the 1870s. So.
That's true. We did just watch Gangs in New York. There was a lot of blackface in that. Jack Langrish would have found a way, damn it.
Maybe they're doing something about Jefferson instead, the original.
Maybe.
Obviously, the Chesterton, they're doing something about Benjamin Franklin.
He looks a lot like Benjamin Franklin.
Good call. The like Benjamin Franklin musical. Is Benjamin Franklin, when did he die?
Not soon enough, if you ask me.
Before 1800, I think, at least.
Yeah, I know Papa's a Franklin. Anyway, speaking of Benjamin Franklin,
Jane's a mess.
Jane is a mess. Like his hair, Jane's a mess.
Yeah, she's super drunk.
And Joni's a mess. Yeah.
No, Joni's going on there. Joni's okay.
She's not.
She's helping out a mental mess. She's helping
she
out.
She is a mental mess. By making out with her. Oh, John, you feel bad and have the flu. Let's make out.
Like, there is some level of, like, awkward sexual chemistry between the two of them, and I'm totally fine with it. I enjoy it. I like it. It works for their characters.
If you take that totally out of context.
Yes, I heard myself, and I was hoping to just blast on past it. But here we are.
I like it. I like the two women making out.
filthy Jane and Joni. Yeah, that's what does it for me.
Well, you've always expressed how much you love each character, and now that they love each other, you've got to be like super on board.
I'm happy for them. I mean, I hope Jane can pull it together. Last thing, Blazanov really yes. steps up in these episodes. He is deeply moved by finding Pasco's body because it takes him back to his parents and imagining about the people that found them when they were murdered on their farm by whoever. And he has previously proclaimed his allegiance to the principle of confidentiality of messages, but because he sees how useless that is in the face of what's coming, he goes to Al after Hurst has received a telegram calling for reinforcements. So now Al knows that reinforcements are coming and will plan accordingly, I would imagine. Great scenes with Blazanov. The scene where he tells Al and like stomps on the floor and steps like across the camera to just really make his point. That gets me. That hits me in the chest.
Yeah, reading AV Club review of that, he talks about basically Blazanov has a Joestrian duty in humanity and chooses humanity.
Yeah. Yeah. Well done, AV Club. Todd VanderWerf, he did a great write-up on the Deadwood series. Not as good as our podcast breakdown, of course, but still pretty good. Scenes of the week, Brian.
Yes. My scene of the week is Charlie's speech about predicting what Hurst is going to do as like my realization that this is the beginning of the end of the series.
I really like that he invokes Bill, this icon of the West, but Bill died a long time ago. Bill is a symbol of the West, and just that period is ending, especially for Deadwood. And they come to a better decision in the camp. It, like, there still might be the big conflagration, but it won't be because of them.
By Bill dying a long time ago, you mean like a year or two?
Yeah, about a year. Yeah.
Okay.
But that's like that's one of like the foundational events of Deadwood that like brought the community together, like the death of this icon celebrity.
Okay.
They don't need Bill anymore. Like, there are children that go to school in this camp now. There's a bank. It's not the Old West anymore.
The bank is not FDIC insured. They need to watch
anything,
out.
Is anything?
No, the FDIC was from the Great Depression.
Great Depression, right. Yeah, but, I mean, we see Alma just really selling Merrick on the bank. Like, it's all very, local. The gold is a little bit away, and everyone that works there lives in town, and yeah, it's very local.
But now there's no one that works there. Except Alma.
Saul still works there. Saul's really getting the short shrift this season so far.
Yeah.
Yeah. What is he doing? Like, he's not doing anything. He works there. You just see him like standing around and seeing the scene.
I take that back. He says in the episode that he spends most of his time at the hardware store. Presumably now that Trixie has quit, he'll spend more time at the bank, but he is an officer in the bank. Whatever that means.
Well, yeah, I don't wonder what that does mean. But that doesn't mean he's an employee. He doesn't work there.
I'm sure he could like slot in. And that might
somebody's going to have to.
That might be me being a little anti-Semitic, assuming that the Jew can just work at the bank with no prior training. But here we are.
Speaking of slots, your slot for Scene of the Week.
Yeah, Alma hitting on Ellsworth, and just like the minutia of the acting, is what really sells me on this scene and makes it monumental in the course of the series. It's just very subtle changes on faces because the two actors are playing it so close to each other. And then you can like see the arc of the scene playing out. Like Ellsworth's elation that his wife is interested in him, where he was pretty sure that was never going to happen. Alma preparing for their union by turning the mirror away so she wouldn't have to see herself having sex with Ellsworth. Ellsworth's crushing disappointment in seeing what's happening once he realizes that Alma is high. And Alma is very clearly high in the way that she's reacting to things. And then just the kiss-off of the scene where Ellsworth tells Alma to not forget about Sophia because dope addicts forget. It's a poison cherry on the top of that sundae. Episode 5 is a fantastic, great, essentially flawless episode. It's not the best scene in it. It might be the best acted scene in it. Shane, scene of the week?
Take us down a little bit.
Mm.
I just want to talk about Con Stapleton talking to some titties.
Much like The Gem is a playhouse for the titlicker, the Billy Union is also an adult playground for those who would pretend to be children in a submarine.
Khan is just like...
Or the equivalent of a submarine in 1876. Like, I don't know if 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea is out yet. But.
He just continues to become... like he rises up my list of characters that I just love from this show. Just like Johnny Burns did the second time I watched it. Probably like my fourth time, fifth time watching it now in Con. It's just great.
I'm wrestling with whether or not to say this, so I'm just going to go ahead and do it. We haven't even seen Con Stapleton's showpiece scene yet. That's something to look forward to, Brian. We're going to see the best that Con Stapleton has to offer. I'm so excited about it that
I almost muted this after you said I'm not sure I want to say this.
We're going to see some Con Stapleton greatness. And then the series is going to end
pants.
Because there's nothing left to do after that point.
Damn Chinese shrunk pants.
Character focus. Dan Doherty. He gets that episode 5 showpiece. We only have so many opportunities to talk about characters. So we're like really call out characters going forward. And I've got a pretty good idea of who we're going to pick for the last two. But Dan Doherty, just big brother, gets sent out to die. We talked a lot about that fight already. This Dan's role in the gem. Let's just say Al's not going to send out Johnny to fight Captain Turner.
What would that look like? Let's just pretend for a second.
It would be bad. Johnny would run. Or Johnny would pull out a gun and just shoot him in the head. But Dan, as much of a brute as he is, has that sense of fair play. And we're watching Stranger Things now. Those characters talk about friends don't lie to each other. They have a very strict sense of what the rules are within relationships. And Dan has a lot of that with Al, because he expects certain things out of Al, and Al is always having to prop Dan up. He talks about having his feelings hurt. It's just a really nice juxtaposition of someone who can pop a guy's eye out in public and then bludgeon him to death with a piece of wood. But that same guy also will go sit in the corner and cry when his boss doesn't pick him for a job.
It's got a code, damn it.
Yeah.
I think my favorite thing about Dan is his style sense, where he goes shirtless with the suspenders and greases himself up.
Yeah,
quality.
I love that scene of them getting ready. It's so fucking great.
And like just the way the scene opens, even like it's just Dan looking at himself in a mirror with that very specific look on his face, just all focus and psyching himself up.
See, I thought he was like lubing himself up so he'd be like hard to grapple.
Well, yeah,
he puts
definitely.
His shirt on.
Like him going out to fight shirtless. I don't know. I feel like you leave yourself open. Like, the I don't think the captain is above, like, nuclear titty twisters.
Or just freaking bit, that guy he bit right his off. Face.
Yeah, bit his face pretty good. And I don't think Dan would be above that either.
Right. I didn't understand why he lubed himself up, but whatever. It was a great scene.
Like I'm saying, like I do love this the Dan character. First watch, I just didn't pay as much attention to him. The second time, because just by the end of it, you just think it's such a real character. Because of the whole amount of emotions that we're seeing with him, and he's just an interesting character. And W. Earl Brown. There we go.
Who found himself in the writer's room this season, dictating notes to David Milchen, writer's credits for it.
If I follow him on Twitter, I've read some articles from him, some things he said. It just like he's all in on this show, and I think it's definitely the cap of like his entire career.
I have no doubt a lot of actors in the show would say exactly that. Like Alan Sepinwall, the TV critic for HitFix.com, during the last three summers, he did a season of Deadwood each, and he would get like actors like Jim Beaver, who plays Ellsworth, and Keanu Young, who plays Mr. Wu, and Garrett Dillahunt, and W. Earl Brown, getting together on the comment boards and commenting on their parts in the episodes and what they thought about the episodes and scenes that they weren't in and what it was like on set. This is a big deal for the actors in this show, especially like the character actors.
While we're talking about characters and other things, there is a show about banking coming out where Mrs. Bullock is the main character.
That is a movie called Equity, actually.
Yeah, I've heard of advertisements on NPR. So there you go.
It just skirted past my radar. I mean, it's on there, but it barely made it.
Like anything mentioned on NPR is automatically at the top of my queue.
Right, fair enough. Quotes for these three episodes. Brian, you want to kick us off with your first one?
For a second, my first quote is talking to Al. Save us. Think of something.
And a rare Jane clean quote.
Ooh.
Do not employ a mug. Lest next week we be donning white gloves. It's a great scene. I love watching her and Aunt Lou sit down. Just pounds of fucking whiskey.
Brian?
I've got when Aunt Lou's son, I've already forgot his name.
His name is Odell.
Odell, that's right. Walks
it's
into
not
Tom.
Junior.
it's. he walks into Tom Nuttall's bar and Tom looks. And says, his name is Steve.
That's so good.
Because he's so mad at Steve, which is so good. I love when he's mad at Steve.
My next one, another EB, talking to Richardson. I imagine the pool that spawned you. I am filling it with rocks.
That's great. We'll stick with Richardson. In Hearst. There's some, I wish I could read them all, but... what do you know of last night? My stomach hurt. Stupid, aren't you? Yes, sir.
I made a note about that scene. Hearst, as he says to Richardson, I'm taking measures to bring this camp down. Or this camp displeases me. I'm taking measures to bring it down. And Richardson just says, all right.
All right.
Like, Hearst clearly wanted some kind of response from him. Like, oh, no, please don't do that. I live here. I work here. All my antlers are here. I founded my religion in this spot. but Richardson, nothing. He gives him nothing.
Are they acting now? They're performing now? Yeah, dude.
And he's sitting like no adult ever sat past the age of, we'll say 11 or 12, with his head resting on both of his upturned fists. I've got a Langreish for my last one. He is debriefing at the end of the day with Al, and Al regrets not inviting him, and Langrish's response is, what topic command in my presence? Reprobates? The elderly? The true partnership, Al and Langrish. Brian, you got one more?
Nope, that's it.
Okay.
I got one more exchange. Great. How's the finger? All right, Mr. Hearst. And then Bullet comes in. How's the fucking ear? Just completely not good. Not your strong point, Bullock. Sick burns.
Not a subtle guy. Not a subtle guy. I mean, Brian, you must have been gratified this week to see Bullock essentially put the entire camp at risk. This guy's going to burn it all down. it's going to be Bullock's fault.
I don't know. I was fine with it.
Okay. Well, we're going to see how fine you are with it, because we're going to do that exact scene for Cruel Masquerade.
We're going to do the how's your ear?
No, we're going to do Bullock arresting Hurst, in which Brian is Cy, Shane is Hurst, and I'm Seth. So teeth are clenched.
I should have practiced. I don't remember how Cy's cadence here. That's okay.
All right. We'll feel our way through it. You lead us off whenever you're ready.
Mr. Hurst, I regret not being out here with you before. Sir, help too stupid to wake me from my nap.
You're drunk.
Not at all.
Were you talking to me Shane's drunk. On down there now. Jack, at least do that much right. Hell of a day.
How much do you know?
I heard there was a set to in the thoroughfare.
Did you know it was my man killed?
Was that the outcome?
My man was killed, yes.
I'm sorry.
It happens. It's the nature of things.
It don't lessen the sadness when it's a friend's. The sheriff joins us.
Whiskey.
The sheriff recently put me on notice. He is vigilant of my possible transgressions.
You sound drunk to me.
Whom are you addressing?
You. You sound drunk.
Do I?
Hmm.
When I say, fuck yourself, Sheriff, will you put that down to drunkenness or a high estimate of your athleticism?
Did you just tell me to fuck myself?
I think I did, and to shut up or I'll quiet you myself.
You're under arrest.
Fuck you. And shut up or I'll shut you up for good.
Threatening a peace officer. I'm taking you into custody.
Don't be stupid, Bullock.
Don't you be fucking stupid.
Yelp.
Fuck you.
That was a good yelp of pain.
Cruel Masquerade. Yeah, that sounded like Hearst to me. 100%. Guys, any final thoughts about the instigation phase of third season of Deadwood, third and final?
It's just a great build up and calm, and then rebuilding the tension again. How do you have it's like how many shows have a peak like that right in the damn middle of the season with Doherty and Captain, and then cool things down, and then successfully you're able to start building the tension right back up like they do in episode Unauthorized Cinnamon, which. Yeah. Great episode name.
Yes.
We didn't even mention why it was called that.
We talked about the cinnamon. Yeah.
We didn't talk about what happened from the cinnamon.
Poor Harry.
Oh, poor Harry Manning. Well, he's new to the ritual, so this is like his initiation, I think, is the point of that.
Is that the original cinnamon challenge?
Maybe it is. You find a guy who farts a lot and he wants to be a fireman, and then you feed him some peaches with cinnamon, and if you can keep him down, he passes.
All right.
But it's not as conducive to YouTube because you got to follow them
so, over an hour and a half. So my question is, is the cinnamon bad or is he just allergic?
He's just allergic. That's it.
Because they asked who all had the cinnamon and it was only him.
He's just allergic to cinnamon, but he is also the only one to use it and he scarfs it all down because he is not familiar with the ritual of the peaches.
His fire idea is pretty good.
Yeah, but just run for fire chief then. Be the fire chief. Don't run for sheriff to be the fire chief.
Okay. I still think it could be in bad cinnamon.
I mean,
I'm like 95%.
Are you doubting the cleanliness of Jules' kitchen? Because she will kick you in the ass with the boot that Doc made her.
Damn right.
That's also something to talk about is Doc. Not a lot there. Doc also gets short shrift this season. He's basically
because he's almost dead.
Yeah, because he's an extremist. But you know,
did someone mention something about getting a new doctor in one of these three episodes?
So we should put notice in the Eastern papers and then out.
Yeah, that's right.
Once we've ceased our weeping,
and then he also says he's like, doesn't he yell at Doc in this episode?
Yes. At the very end, he throws all his scarves at him.
Everyone's got their weaknesses. I can't. This is just yours. Yeah. Shut the fuck up. I don't want to meet a new doc.
Yeah.
Great. Which is a bad plan.
Yeah, like between him and Len Grieche telling people they're not allowed to die, I think it's too good to.
Yes, that's
like linking
that's
those
thematic
two characters
consistency
together.
Is
yeah.
what that is.
Yeah, I think it's great.
It's
two guys
almost
who,
like this series is written by the greatest TV writer of all time.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the 5 and 7 are almost certainly in my top 10 Deadwood episodes. We'll revisit that at the end of the this run, I would imagine. And I would imagine one or both is in the top 5 too. Like, Unauthorized Cinnamon is like an emotional powerhouse, and then a Two-Headed Beast is it contains that scene in the thoroughfare, and there are a few things better than that.
Yeah.
But Brian, you like the 6th episode the best.
I did. Everybody was included. It's nice.
You're a freaking communist.
I have good news. The Room is coming to the Art Theater in Champaign.
It's fantastic. It's here one Tuesday every month.
We think it's the last Tuesday at the Plaza
yeah,
Theater on Ponce de Leon Avenue. Avenue?
Yeah,
there's so
sure.
many. You drive by like Ponce de Leon Court, Ponce de Leon Boulevard.
Yeah, it's on Ponce.
Okay.
You say on.
Thanks for joining me tonight, guys. Find us on the internet at MunichandMovie.club. Like us on Facebook, Munich and Movie Club. We are wrapping up our discussion of School Days, Spike Lee's School Days, and
fucking
we'll
Majestic.
Be talking about...
There we go.
That's what's called the Majestic?
Majestic.
All right, well
Majestic
done.
Guys, fantastic.
Brian is our next jefe, and he picked 4 Lions. That should go up tomorrow?
Oh, man. I'll try.
Okay. Certainly this week.
Can I leave you guys one quote from all this that completely glossed over?
100%.
And as you just think about this in our current political climate and what's going on and all the stupid Facebook comments, people are fucking people, and that is fucked up. Calamity Jane.
Thanks for joining me tonight, guys.
Thanks, John.
Have a good night.
See ya.